Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Historic Wilderness Act. In 1964, Congress designated 9 million acres of wild American lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System. Since then, 100 million more acres of wilderness has been designated as federally protected and preserved unspoiled land. This covers roughly 5% of the land in the United States. Roughly 50% of it is in Alaska. The Wilderness Act has been described as one of the most eloquently written pieces of legislation, which calls for the preservation and protection of some of the most natural and undisturbed places in the country. The Act states, quote, "A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain," end quote. So what has the Wilderness Act achieved? What does wilderness mean today, and what needs to be added to the National Wilderness Preservation System? Today, we're joined by Vicki Hoover. She's been a staffer with the Sierra Club, an outings leader, and public lands and wilderness advocate since the late 1960s. She's been involved in multiple conservation campaigns in Alaska, Utah, Nevada, and here in California. Vicki is co-chair of Wilderness 50, the national planning team for the 50th anniversary of America's Wilderness Act. And Vicki joins me here in studio. Hi, Vicki. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you, Rose. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk about my very favorite topic, wilderness.
Well, and you're wearing a wilderness t-shirt.
Well, I am. This is one for the made for the 50th anniversary with the official logo on it.
Well, thank you for coming in. We're also joined today by Rose Chilcote. She's Associate Director of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness. That's a national organization that uses the voices and activism of elders to preserve and protect wilderness and wild public lands. Hi, Rose. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Mark Harvey, Professor of History at North Dakota State and author of Wilderness Forever, Howard Zanizer and the Path to the Wilderness Act. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
Good morning. Great to have all of you. So why don't we talk about what the word wilderness really means? Because we've got a lot of land management policies in the United States, a lot of agencies like the Forest Service, the National Park Service, BLM. So, Mark, what do we mean when we say an area is designated wilderness?
Well, you'll probably get different answers depending on who you ask. I'm the historian here in the crowd, so my response will be kind of rooted in history. It partly means an area that is without roads, and that certainly was the kind of foundational purpose of setting aside American wilderness. Beginning back in the 1920s was a roadless area, and that certainly remains at the core of what it means today. And because it's an area without roads, it's an area without where motorized vehicles or really any kind of mechanization, including chainsaws, are prohibited. So that also means it's a place of quiet and of solitude, and where nature itself is clearly dominant.
Vicki, what would you add to that?
Well, we could go back even farther and talk about the meaning of the actual word as a word. The word wilderness comes from the Old English and is based on the simple word will. And we all talk about our will, and we know what will means, and that will refers to free will and land that has a will of its own, meaning it can do its own thing without being controlled by others, particularly us humans. So wilderness is really free land uncontrolled by us.
Rose, do you think that we have that the same definition that was, well, people talked about wilderness in 1964, the way they talked about it back then? Do we think of wilderness like that today?
Well, absolutely. There's a very large contingent of Americans who think of wilderness exactly as it was intended when the Wilderness Act was passed. Unfortunately, there are future generations that I believe don't have the experience being in the outdoors and with wild nature to really understand what true wilderness is. And that's one of the big challenges as we look forward. But absolutely, wilderness is, per the Wilderness Act, you know, that place that is self-willed, that is untrammeled by man. And that's a really interesting word that was in the language of the Act, that a lot of people think it means, you know, without footprints or absolutely purely pristine. And what it really means is unconstrained by man's activities. So it's allowed, you know, as Vicki said, that free will where nature and the natural processes can unfold without us, you know, directing it.
And Mark, talk a little bit about what the climate was like back in 1964 when the Act was passed. It was passed almost unanimously, right, which is almost unheard of in today's political climate.
Yeah, it was. It's quite remarkable to think back on the overwhelming support that it had. Of course, it also took a while to get the Wilderness Act through Congress. It took 8 years. So even though in the end there was widespread support, there was only one member of the House that voted against it in 1964. But nonetheless, it was an eight-year effort by many organizations across the country to get it passed. And, you know, it went through innumerable drafts. And Howard Zonizer, who was the leader of the Wilderness Society, was really the person in Washington who, you know, was responsible for so much of the drafting and readjusting and revising and doing all of the kind of incredible detail work with the federal agencies and with other conservation and environmental organizations to, you know, to ultimately produce a bill that could get support in Congress. So Zonizer was, you know, he gets a lot of credit for making this happen.
So this went through 66 revisions, and sadly, Zonizer died 4 months before the law was actually signed on September 3rd, 1964.
He did. He died of a heart attack on May 5th of that year. He was 58 years old, so he was, you know, relatively young. He had had heart troubles off and on throughout his adult life. And yeah, I mean, it was very sad. It was very tragic. And it happened really just sort of virtually on the eve of when Lyndon Johnson signed the bill in the fall of that year.
And Vicki, talk a little bit about how politicians determined what land to protect at that time, because back in 1964, Congress designated 9 million acres of wild lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System.
Okay, and you wonder how did they select what lands to protect? Well, back in the 20s and 30s, the Forest Service, one of the major land managing agencies, had administratively, no laws were involved, but just they had decided that they would set aside as primitive areas or wild areas, or in some cases they actually called them wilderness areas, most of their roadless lands that were pretty big throughout in national forests around the country. And they did. They set these aside administratively to be free from timber cutting, from roads, and to keep them roadless. And conservationists thought that was pretty good. Here, in fact, some of them, like people like Bob Marshall and Aldo Leopold, had been instrumental in the Forest Service to make this happen. Well, it was those lands that had previously been administratively set aside, identified and set aside as wild by the Forest Service, that automatically were whisked into the newly created National Wilderness Preservation System at the passage of the Act. So they didn't really have to identify new lands at that time. They designated as wilderness in the new system those lands previously set aside.
And so then in the last 50 years, since then, 100 million acres have been designated as federally protected.
Oh, yes,
land.
We've been pretty busy in the last 50 years, and we're not done yet.
So talk about what did that look like? I mean, what was that fight like? Did it get harder over the years?
Oh, well, the Wilderness Act required that in order for additional lands to be designated as wilderness, each time an act of Congress was required. this made it sort of hard, difficult. It's not that easy to get Congress to pass a good bill. So it meant that when wilderness advocates in a particular state wanted to have some of their land set aside as wilderness, they had to study them pretty well, draw maps pretty carefully, have good arguments showing that these lands were truly wild, and then they had to get a lot of political support. They had to get somebody, a member of Congress, or more than one member of Congress, to introduce a bill into Congress, work to get support for getting it passed. So it was a lot of work each time. Now, the Wilderness Act also had a provision in it that required both the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service to study their roadless lands over the next 10 years after the act was passed to see if any of their lands were eligible for wilderness. So that work for additional lands of Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service was already kind of built into the act.
And Rose, what really strikes you about how the act has evolved over the last 50 years?
Well, one of the things that's really shifted is the way that grassroots has grassroots support from just average citizens and people who had a real passion and love for wild places has played a role. When the Wilderness Act first passed, there were, as Vicki said, a lot of places that were already ripe for designation. And then it fell to people to recommend and help support the agency's recommendations for new areas to be considered for wilderness designation. And it took average citizens who had wild places in their backyard to step up and really be passionate advocates for place. And that played a very huge role in those early decades after the bill was passed in getting wilderness designated. In this day and age, it seems that many more conservation organizations have professional staff and people who are working on wilderness campaigns in various states, but the actual campaigns are much smaller in scope. You don't see these big statewide bills passing anymore. And so the effort to get wilderness through Congress, which is ultimately the destination, you need to have a bill that will pass Congress, is much more driven by people who have lobbyists in D.C., who have staff who can work on these bills for years, decades. I mean, none of this happens quickly. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in the last decade or two, it seems that grassroots pushing these bills forward has diminished, and yet it's still an essential part of the equation. And that's one of the things that Great Old Broads for Wilderness and the Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club that Vicki represents, we bring the grassroots to these campaigns. But it's been a shift in how strategically wilderness gets moved through Congress.
You know, the largest single wilderness bill passed for the lower 48, that's excluding Alaska, of course, was the California Desert Protection Act, signed by President Clinton in 1994. So this year, actually, we Californians are celebrating big time the 20th anniversary of that big legislation. That single bill designated a lot of wilderness, and for the first time, it brought the Bureau of Land Management into becoming a big-time wilderness managing agency. They had not been a player in the original Wilderness Act or mentioned in it because way back in those days, 50 years ago, the BLM had not even had any kind of requirement to study its roadless areas yet and did not have a mission of protecting roadless areas. So it got to be a player for wilderness quite a bit later.
That is Vicki Hoover. She has been a staffer with the Sierra Club, an outings leader, and public lands and wilderness advocate since the late 1960s. And she's co-chair of Wilderness 50, the national planning team for the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. We're also joined by Rose Chilcote, associate director of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, a national organization that uses the voices and activism of elders to preserve and protect wilderness and wild public lands. And Mark Harvey is professor of history at North Dakota State and author of Wilderness Forever, Howard Zonizer and the Path to the Wilderness Act. And on today's Your Call, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the historic Wilderness Act. In 1964, Congress designated 9 million acres of wild lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System. Today, there are 100 million acres of wilderness land that is protected and preserved. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the Wilderness Act and how far we have come over the last 50 years? What are some of your favorite wilderness areas? And how do you think we can ensure even more land is protected in the next 50 years, especially in today's political climate? The toll-free number is 866, because this act passed almost unanimously back then. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Mark, we talked a little bit about the past and how this act came into existence. Talk a little bit about what the environmental movement was like back in the early 1960s.
Well, it was a diverse kind of movement, but probably was more closely related to the first half of the 20th century than the second half. That is, in 1964, when the Wilderness Act passed, the dominant organizations were the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, the Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation. So they were mostly organizations concerned with wildlife, parks, wilderness, and sort of those older kind of conservation, interests. The mid-60s, of course, is when environmentalism begins to emerge, when people begin to worry about pollution and pesticides, and Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, had come out. So, 1964 is kind of right sort of in between the older conservation movement and the newer environmental movement. But I think that when the Wilderness Act passed in 1964, and as wilderness became more popular in the 60s and 70s, and as more wilderness areas were added to the system, I think that a lot of environmentalists, or people who identified themselves as environmentalists rather than conservationists, included the Wilderness Act in the sort of, body of achievements that they believed environmentalism had brought along.
And Vicki, you've been active since the late 1960s in these movements. What stands out for you in terms of what you remember?
Well, I was active, but in the 1960s, I really didn't know anything about the Wilderness Act as legislation. Oh, yes, I was out there hiking and leading outings in wilderness up in the Sierra Nevada and enjoying the benefits of it, but I didn't understand at that time how wilderness didn't just happen to be these beautiful wild lands preserved for us to enjoy, but it had required the hard work of so many people to take care of it. So it wasn't till somewhat later, probably around the time of the passage of the California Wilderness Act of 1984, 30 years ago, and that was a subsequent act in California, which actually was the bill that brought us our big wilderness areas in our national parks like Yosemite and Sequoia. Mm. So we've had wilderness, official wilderness there for 30 years. It was about that time that I became aware that it was that you really needed to work at it to preserve wilderness, and that it was important to get more areas for other people in the future the way I had enjoyed wilderness in the past and in the present too, and that it was very important and remains very important to get young people involved in this effort, because they are going to be the next generation of wilderness advocates.
Well, let's hear from a few listeners before we go to break. Let's go to Rob in Sausalito. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My name is Rob Badger. I'm a conservation photographer. I believe I may have worked with Vicki on the on the Desert Protection Act. And, Vicki, I just want to give you so much gratitude for your tireless energy. I know you've been doing this for years. I've seen you in action, so thank you very much for what you've done. My question is about what is allowed on public lands. I mean, what is allowed on wilderness area? I'm seeing on the Forest Service website and the BLM website that mining is still allowed on claims that exist, that existed at the time the Wilderness Act, at the time that those specific wildernesses were created. My question is, what activity that is disruptive, meaning that harms the ecosystems there, is still allowed on these wilderness lands?
Shall I speak to
Please,
that?
Yes, Vicki.
Probably the most physically harmful activity to the land itself that is permitted in wilderness is commercial cattle grazing. That is a bit of a political compromise. Originally, the framers of the Wilderness Act, when they were planning this in back in the 1950s, envisioned a whole system of wildlands without commercial grazing. But they learned as soon as they started bringing this to Congress that it could not get through Congress because of it would have too strong an opposition from Western senators whose lands had a lot of grazing, and it simply would not fly unless grazing was allowed, and it became permitted in the Act and still remains that way to this day.
Hmm. Rose, what would you add to that?
Well, I would echo what Vicki said, that, you know, grazing of domestic livestock in wilderness is the single, probably most disruptive ecologically activity, and it's also problematic for people who are experiencing wilderness, as well as all the other creatures that depend on those wild areas for their very existence. Other things that come to mind that sometimes can confound people, well, with the livestock grazing, the ranchers are sometimes allowed to actually drive vehicles into wilderness, which is inconsistent with the language of the Act, but it was an exception that was made so that they could take supplies in for fence building, which again seems inconsistent but is allowed, and development of water features. The use of mechanical equipment in the case of emergency situations, like bringing helicopters in for life-threatening rescues, or when there is fire in a wilderness that's perhaps adjacent to a community, the agencies are given some latitude to go through a decision process, the minimum tool process, to make a decision as to whether those kinds of activities can occur. So while we like to think of wilderness as really a pure and absolutely hands-off management situation, there can be some really inconsistent things that come to light, like the mining that Rob mentioned.
And we have an email from Jim who says, I'm a regular visitor to wilderness areas and crave the chance to spend time out of the sight of humans, buildings, and cars. I've noticed a number of permitted and banned activities that strike me as anomalies. In a Wyoming wilderness, I've seen sheep grazing and understand there are still golden trout being planted by helicopter. In the River of No Return, there are a host of active airstrips permitted. He says, I realize that lots of contradictions were codified in order to gain acceptance. Well, thanks for the email, Jim. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the Historic Wilderness Act. In 1964, Congress designated 9 million acres of wild lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System. And since then, 100 million more acres of wilderness has been designated as federally protected and preserved unspoiled wild land. So what's next in 50 years, and what are some of your favorite wilderness areas? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on local public radio KALW. To join in today's conversation, the number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices and new ideas. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And at noon today, Backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation about the recent two-day strike on UC campuses. Earlier this month, students hit the picket lines accusing administrators of unfair labor practices and intimidation, including threats to take away visas for grad student protesters and to fire those who strike. So what's next for these grad students and what are their demands? And then on Wednesday, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about food labeling. It seems like when you buy things, actually I have a little thing of oatmeal right here. And on this one oatmeal, there's non-GMO, certified gluten-free, USDA organic, vegan certified. So what do all these labels mean, and what can you trust, and why have so many labels on them? That's on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are marking the 50th anniversary of the Historic Wilderness Act. In 1964, Congress designated 9 million acres of wild American lands into the National Wilderness Preservation System. Today, there are 100 million acres of wilderness. So we're talking today about what's been accomplished over the last 50 years and what's next. What does wilderness mean today? What are some of your favorite areas? What are some of the biggest threats today? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Vicki Hoover. She has been a staffer with the Sierra Club, an outings leader and public land and wilderness advocate since the late 1960s. Vicki is co-chair of Wilderness 50, the national planning team for the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. Rose Chilcote is associate director of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, a national organization that uses the voices and activism of elders to preserve and protect wild lands. And Mark Harvey is professor of history at North Dakota State and the author of Wilderness Forever, Howard Zonizer and the Path to the Wilderness Act. And thanks again for calling, Rob. Thanks for your email, Jim. And let's go next to Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Mike Painter, and I represent Californians for Western Wilderness in San Francisco. And we're a citizens group that believes that citizen involvement is an important part of the wilderness movement, both getting new areas designated, but also making sure that designated areas are managed properly. And so we work to be a clearinghouse for information for people to make it easier for them to be involved in decision-making. And we've worked closely with the Great Old Broads and the Sierra Club, among other organizations. So we let people know when upcoming legislation is in the works, when agencies are preparing environmental impact statements and things like that. So we send out a once-a-month newsletter letting people know what the current issues are, and do slideshows and things like that.
So can you elaborate when you say that you try to make sure that these areas are managed properly?
Well, when, or hopefully not managed.
it's a great oxymoron, Mike, right?
Right.
But very often projects are proposed that affect wilderness, such as some of the solar installations in the desert or large-scale oil and gas developments may have impacts on adjoining wilderness or prevent areas that are proposed for wilderness designations from actually being designated. Mm. When you're in a national park, for example, the Park Service is required to prepare a management plan for their wilderness areas, which involves things like trail maintenance and things like that, how much pack stock horses can be used, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. And thank you so much for calling in, Mark. Mark, I know we need to let Mark Harvey, we need to let you go in a couple minutes, but can you talk a little bit about development and how this has changed the notion of wilderness, because I was just in Sequoia National Park and was so pleased to learn that the hotel that they built, the convenience store they built, there was so much commerce, so much transportation, which really disrupted the land. It disrupted the trees. And they decided to get rid of all of it. And they built a very unassuming lodge and an unassuming hotel, which they say does not disrupt as much as the old hotel. And it was just kind of nice to see that. You just don't hear stories like that much anymore.
Right. I guess there's a question in there somewhere.
Well, the development, how has that changed the notion of wilderness?
You know, I think I'm going to defer to one of your other two guests on this, because they know more about that park than I do.
Yes, and thank you, Mark. And I was just in Sequoia National Park too, and I saw the rebuilt lodge that Rose mentioned. The point of it was that they moved it from a sensitive area very close to the giant sequoias. They moved the development to a less sensitive area farther from what the park is trying to protect. But, of course, the point is that a national park, as they were established, is really not wilderness. It happens that Sequoia National Park has a lot of designated wilderness in it, but it wouldn't be near the roads or the developments at all. There would be nothing like that allowed within the park wilderness. In fact, most of Sequoia National Park is designated wilderness, everything except for the road corridors and the developed areas with visitor centers, parking lots for trails, and, of course, the lodge or lodges and the car camping campgrounds.
Yeah. If I could say, I worked for the National Park Service for a number of years, and one of the purpose of the parks is to preserve and protect resources unimpaired for future generations, while at the same time providing for the use and enjoyment thereof. And that's where those developments and the idea of lodges and roads and, you know, people being able to come into and experience the parks came from. Many parks, like Vicki described, Sequoia, have a number of parks have designated wilderness. Many of the parks have areas that have been identified as having wilderness character, but a disturbing number of parks have no permanent protection of those areas as congressionally designated wilderness. There's an assumption, I think, that because it's a national park, it's wilderness, and that's not necessarily true.
And why is that?
I think it's a lack of understanding of the American people that, you know, a park, while it's very highly protected, is a lesser level of protection, actually, than wilderness, which is the gold standard for the most pure, ecologically functioning, you know, area that we could have.
And Mark, before we let you go, what's in store for the future of preserving and protecting wildlands?
Well, again, your other guests would have good opinions about that, but I think most of us who cherish and appreciate wilderness like to think that the wilderness system can grow to 200 million acres or 300 million acres. But I know also that we're even sometimes reluctant to throw out numbers like that because, you know, we sort of don't want there to be any kind of an end. I wonder if I could just throw in one more thing before I have to go teach a class.
Please.
And it has to do with sort of the values that we place on wilderness. Mm. And Howard Zonizer, who wrote much of the Wilderness Act, certainly was an eloquent spokesperson for this. But I just want to read you one sentence that he wrote back in 1955, which I think speaks a lot about how people valued wilderness then and continue to value it now. He said this: "To know the wilderness is to know a profound humility, to recognize one's littleness, to sense dependence and interdependence and responsibility." I like that because I think it sort of is a reminder to people that we share the planet with other forms of life, And that's one of the reminders, I think, that wilderness gives us.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mark, and thanks for that beautiful quote. I think that says it all.
Thank you.
Thank
I'm
you,
sorry
Mark.
I have to run.
Well, thank you. Have a good class. That's Mark
okay,
Harvey.
Bye.
He's professor of history at North Dakota State and author of Wilderness Forever, Howard Zonizer and the Path to the Wilderness Act. And Vicki, since you were just in Sequoia and I was there, I mean, that quote really speaks to you when you're standing in front of a 3,000-year-old tree, mm-hmm. One of the most amazing, two of the most amazing trees in the world are in Sequoia National Park, the largest.
That is true. That is certainly a very special feature. The giant sequoias are a very special marvel, a natural marvel that we enjoy in California. They are, of course, not all in Sequoia National Park, far from it. Some of the additional groves of giant sequoias are protected or slightly protected in the Giant Sequoia National Monument, which is managed by the Forest Service. And one of the Sierra Club's efforts has been to try to get good management plan for the national monument there. But there are additional giant sequoia groves that are not protected in the adjoining national forests, too. But I would just like to, we've been talking a lot about numbers and how much area is protected as wilderness. And Rose, you mentioned how initially it was 9 million acres and now it's about 110. I just wanted to put those numbers a little bit into context for people who maybe don't quite visualize what an acre is or what a million acres is. California, our state here, is total area of California is almost exactly 100 million acres. So if all the wilderness areas in our country, including Alaska, were all lumped together in one spot, which of course they're not since they're widely spread out, but if they were all lumped together, they would be just a little bit larger than the state of California.
Hmm. Well, yeah, that's good perspective.
Yes. So it's really a relatively small amount of land in our country that is protected in that way.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to calls, and if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Steve in Oakland. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I've had the pleasure of enjoying and camping in a lot of our wilderness areas. I've usually taken my dog with me, and generally dogs have been allowed in wilderness areas off-leash with very few exceptions. I understand there should be some exceptions if there's a particular sensitive breeding area for wildlife, and I think there are places where dogs shouldn't go, or for that matter, where humans shouldn't go. But it seems increasingly that some wilderness areas are placing restrictions on dogs. And I noticed that Desolation Wilderness up by Tahoe, they now say they'll enforce the Tuolumne County leash law, and it seems a little strange that a federal agency would be enforcing a county leash law, and I'm wondering if there is some overarching rule within the management as to the access of dogs to wilderness areas.
Vicki?
As far as I know, the only place where dogs are not permitted on the trails in wilderness is within our national parks. But that's a national park regulation rather than a wilderness regulation. In general, people are able to bring pets into wilderness areas that are not also in a national park. Now, there may be specific areas where there are exceptions, and also in a very general way, dogs, it has been seen, do interfere with some respect with wildlife movements nearby.
Uh-huh. Rose, do you want to add something?
Well, yeah, I would. We talked a little bit earlier about the strange concept of wilderness management, and the agencies are more and more being compelled to adopt some more restrictive guidelines. In some cases, it's actual regulations regarding the use of these wilderness areas by people and the things that people bring with them, like their pets. The agencies are, directed to maintain the outstanding opportunities for solitude, to make sure that the areas aren't degraded from use. And, that can be everything from campsites to dogs, a lot of dogs running loose in an area, and, you know, impacts on trails and trail cutting. And the problem with managing wilderness areas really is people management is what it comes down to. There's just so many of us, and especially those wilderness areas that are proximate to urban areas that get a lot of use. Managing numbers of people, where they're going, you know, how many can be in a group, and then by extension, the pets that they bring starts to become something that we see. And I'm a dog lover and have several dogs. I love being able to have my dogs off leash, but sometimes we have to recognize that it's restraint that's necessary for us to experience wilderness. And we really want these places to be as they are in the future, and to do that, we need to be aware of how we're impacting them today.
And that is Rose Chilcote, Associate Director of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, a national organization that uses the voices and activism of elders to preserve and protect wilderness and wild public lands. Vicki Hoover has been a Sierra Club staffer, outings leader, and public lands and wilderness advocate since the late 1960s. She's co-chair of Wilderness 50, the national planning team for the 50th anniversary of America's Wilderness Act. And Mike in San Francisco wants to tell us about one of the local events. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be back on. One of the big activities this year for the Bay Area in Northern California is going to be a Visions of the Wild Festival that's going to be in downtown Vallejo from September 3rd through 6th. And it's being planned by the federal land agencies, Vallejo arts organizations, and conservation organizations, including Californians for Western Wilderness and Tuliomi up in Woodland.
And Sierra Club.
And Sierra Club, exactly. Thank you, Vicki. And we're planning a full program of events, including a walk for wilderness, art exhibitions, speakers, music, panel discussions, youth activities, and more. And Vallejo is one of the most diverse cities in the country, so we're hoping that people from all over the Bay Area and Northern California will attend, especially people from communities that aren't traditionally associated with wilderness.
Huh. Well, thank you for that. And we've got some links about events at our website, yourcallradio.org. We've got some related emails. Aaron writes in and says, I'm interested to hear your guests talk about the roles that Native American groups have played in the history of establishing wilderness. This seems particularly important given that Native people were removed from their historical lands, many of which are now being designated as wilderness and protected from most human use with the exception of cattle grazing. And Joe says, I assume you're going to talk about issues that have arisen around Native Americans and wilderness designation. For example, the displacement of local peoples from the Yosemite area in order to create a, quote, pristine environment. The concept of wilderness as a place untouched by humans is a romantic ideal that has little to do with the long history of humans' involvement in the landscape, as with controlled burning by California Indians to maintain oak woodlands. She says, don't get me wrong, I love going to the wilderness, and I'm glad it exists, but it is not an unproblematic construction. Vicki, do you want to take that one?
I could talk about that particular aspect of wilderness for well over an hour, so obviously I won't. But that is a very important point to keep in mind, that and that Native Americans had a much longer ago connection with wilderness than we later comers who established the National Wilderness Preservation System. Indeed, they lived in wilderness, and of course, it was not ever totally unaffected by them. But the thing about all the activities that Native Americans generally did over the many years to manage the lands around them and to alter them, these were not activities that generally kept the natural processes from happening the way subsequent, more quote-unquote civilized activities have done. These were things that worked more in concert with nature and allowed nature's processes still to be dominant rather than the people. And that is a big difference. Now, as far as removing Indians from their traditional lands, yes, that is a sorry but a long but sorry part of American history that is pretty impossible now for us to go back and alter. But I think there are increasing attempts by the land managing agencies to work with Native Americans that are nearby. And in some cases, there is even an experiment with co-management of wilderness by a Native American group and the federal land managing agencies. There are, I hope, increasing recognitions that we want to work with Native Americans and give them a rightful place in nature, and work with them to make sure that they have a way to help shape the future of wilderness.
Rose, did you have anything to add to that?
I guess just adding that in recognizing wildernesses, areas in their designation, cultural sites, historic and prehistoric, are protected within wilderness. We can't, as Vicki said, we can't change the sorry legacy of how the original Native Americans were handled by our government, but we are, through designating wilderness, able to protect the legacy of those previous inhabitants when they were still living on those lands. So, archaeological sites are protected, and historic cabins even can be protected within a wilderness designated area. As it was pointed out, it's in a way a romantic vision to think that wilderness exists without people. Wilderness is a human construct, but it's so essential to where we are today. When you look back at the history of settlement of America by European settlers, mm-hmm. when they first came here, it was a vast wilderness. And within, mere hundreds of years, we have diminished this country down to, as Vicki pointed out, a very small percentage of land left that's truly wild in character. It will never be perfect, and that's part of the challenge, is how do we honor those who have that authentic original relationship with the land while still maintaining places wild and meeting the needs of an increasingly urbanized population that needs these places of refuge for spiritual reasons, for just a reminder of our heritage, for a place to be inspired, to stand in awe and wonder, whether it's at a giant sequoia tree or a place like the Grand Canyon or the Red Rock Desert of Utah or an ocean seashore. Wilderness is so diverse, and yet people, they don't appreciate it until it's gone, and that's what we're trying to prevent from happening, that loss.
There's also a really good book, American Indians and National Parks, by Robert Keller and Michael Turek. We've been actually wanting to do a show about that. So thank you for the email. Yeah, really interesting. There's another a related question from Aaron. He says, it's been my experience that the wilderness and conservation movement has been dominated by voices of white people. And when we're talking about the Wilderness Act, it's mostly white men, right? I'm wondering if you can both talk about the influence that people of color have had on shaping the wilderness movement in America.
Well, they probably haven't in the past had as much influence as you might like to think, but I think there is increasingly efforts to relate wilderness to people of color, and in California, here where I am, particularly to Spanish-speaking minorities, and we find that people of these communities really have a close connection, rooted way in the past history, way back to Africa, if you wish, or wherever else, a connection with nature, a deep and almost spiritual closeness to nature. It's just that they have not been part of an organized effort to set places aside as designated wilderness in a legislated way. However, one of the many goals of the Wilderness 50 celebration this year, of the anniversary, is to reach out to communities like that and help find the the many threads that tie their lives to wild places in ways that, in which they enjoy being out in nature, and talk to them about that and bring them further into the community of wilderness.
I was struck by the sheer diversity I saw at the at the giant sequoias. And then what was also interesting is the information is in English and Spanish. And I don't remember seeing that just a couple of years ago.
That is part of that new effort I'm talking about to bring Spanish-speaking and other communities closer. And even, interestingly enough, it was only recently as 2009, that the International Wilderness Community came together and officially determined a suitable phrase in the Spanish language to mean wilderness, because in the past, one of the obstacles really has been that there is no one single word in Spanish that has exactly the equivalent meaning of wilderness as we use it in English. So the phrase that's being now used in Spanish is tierras silvestres. The word silvestre, I'm told, does not have the same connotation in Spanish of meaning forested areas as it does in English, so it really refers to wild and unsettled places. People had also used the word tierras salvajes, but salvaje has a connotation of savage, which can mean be more negative in impression it gives to people, so they're discouraging that, and we're using tierras silvestres. And I have seen that on wilderness signs now, and it's a very good trend.
Hmm. Well, thank you for your email, Erin, and thanks for the other email that I read from Joe. We've got about 30 seconds for final thoughts. Vicki, what are your thoughts? I mean, you've been doing this since the late 1960s, and so much has been done.
Hard to put it in 30 seconds, but if somebody wants to do one thing this year, the anniversary year for the cause of wilderness, I would suggest reach out to a young person and take a kid to wilderness with you. Pass the word on. Pass on our legacy of wild places. I would just like to read one other quote from Howard Zahnizer.
Sure.
Mark Harvey read a very nice one, but this is more general, and I find this very inspirational. The wilderness that has come to us from the eternity of the past, we have the boldness to project into the eternity of the future.
Vicki Hoover is co-chair of Wilderness 50, and Rose Chilcote is associate director of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What conditions are UC graduate students working under? On the next Jura Call, we'll have a conversation about the recent two-day strike by the UC Student Workers Union. Earlier this month, students hit the picket line accusing UC administrators of unfair labor practices and intimidation, including threats to take away visas for grad student protesters and fire those who strike. So what's next for these grad students, and what are their demands? Join the conversation on the next Jura Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.